Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on Sydney as a global city. We've got two speakers tonight, both of whom are long-time members and supporters of the Sydney Institute, so it's great to see them coming along to talk to us. Andrew Lowe we'll start with, and then Jacqueline Wilcox. Andrew Lowe, his background is in finance and investment. He ran the Macquarie Group in Asia for about 6 years. He's currently the CEO of Redbridge Grant Samuel, and he's author of the Global Sydney Report, which was commissioned by the Sydney Business Chamber. So Andrew's going to lead off, and Jacqueline Wilcox has a background as a business advisor in relation to crisis and issue management. She's an author, a journalist. She appears regularly on the Paul Murray Live Show on Sky News, and also on the Drum television show. And she's the Senior Strategic Counsel and Head of Public Affairs for Weber Shandwick. And the discussion today is Sydney as a global city. We'll start off with Andrew, we'll go to Jacqueline, then we'll go to question and discussion. Andrew, thank you.
Thanks, Jared. As Jared mentioned, I've spent quite a lot of the last 8 years living and working in Asia. And that sort of experience emphasises on one hand how special, precious and unique Sydney is, and how passionate we need to be about protecting the clean, safe, transparent and creatively vibrant environment that we have here. But at the same time, a close-up view of Asia also brings home how quickly our world is changing. That the era of shipping coal and iron ore may be over, but equally that the 500 million middle-class people in our neighbourhood, it will grow by the time the children currently born are in high school to 3.2 billion and spending 33 trillion a year on services, culture and education. And I think also that cities like Shanghai, Seoul and Singapore, with none of the natural advantages that we have of environment, lifestyle, climate, and even on some measures Melbourne, are overtaking us in many areas through better governance, collaboration of stakeholders, and strategic thinking. An objective analysis of Sydney's position... Let me get this working. An objective analysis of Sydney's position relative to other cities supports a view that we've become a bit complacent since the Olympics. A fall in our contribution to Australian GDP from almost 27% to less than 17%, and in Mercer's livability index rankings, steadily down from 4th over the last decade to 11th. And if we aren't investing wisely in our hard and soft infrastructure, then this relative decline will continue. The PwC analysis on the right shows that Sydney rates close or at the top for sustainability, which is the size of the circle, but most of our competitor cities rate higher for their economy, above us in the chart, and almost all rate higher on transport, which is to the right on the chart. In this report, we focused particularly on the city of Sydney, because this core global gateway generates a quarter of the state's GDP, and it's where our major educational and cultural institutions are based. It's where the bulk of Sydney's 30 million visitors come annually, and where most of the large companies are based. This inner city, global Sydney, drives the rest of New South Wales, and to a large extent, the whole of Australia. as you can see from the next slide, council revenues have grown by 41% over the last 8 years. The council now takes in more than $500 million a year and has net assets of $6.7 billion. This is not a small local council that public perception and the extent of the business engagement would suggest. There's now actually surplus cash of in liquid investments of about $520 million and about $1.5 billion of surplus real estate, things like the Burberry building on Martin Place, the QVB, Customs House, various gyms, theatres and dozens of other properties rented out to different bodies. And our analysis suggests that the council can easily underwrite substantially more than $1 billion over the next 5 years to kickstart infrastructure and urban renewal and still maintain a AAA credit rating with no impact on service provision. So we've started with transport and infrastructure. There's a growing consensus around light rail, but this obviously needs to be implemented in a way that doesn't make traffic congestion worse. The key advantage of a light rail spine down George Street is the ability to remove more than 400, often half-empty buses from the street and make it a more attractive place for walking and shopping. Some consequential changes to laneways on some of the cross streets and on-street parking can make sure that vehicle traffic isn't ignored. Light rail should be free down George Street. The success of public transport is driven largely by patronage, and there are practical advantages around modal interoperability, compliance cost savings and future-proofing, as well as more strategic ones, the increased productivity with having greater connection between offices and dispersing tourist and educational earnings more widely around the city. The operating costs of light rail are actually quite modest and can easily be covered by a small peak access charge for cars on certain key routes from the east and north of the city. This will substantially reduce congestion for those that have to travel by car. And in fact, we estimate that the combination of these charges, probably only a couple of dollars on peak access, fully hypothecated to making the light rail free, and some increased lane capacity on streets like King and Clarence, will actually reduce traffic congestion in the city by of the order of 20 to 25%. The second thing that we've set out in the Global Sydney Report is around 10 strategic sites whose rejuvenation would have multiplier effects on the economy and the livability of our city. This is sometimes called the Guggenheim effect, after the impact on Bilboa of Geary's Museum. And we've seen it on show more recently in Singapore, with the almost 1% GDP pickup as a result of the Marina Bay development. Iconic architecture and an inspiring aesthetic environment, supported by the right traffic and infrastructure, make a city an internationally desirable place to live and work. In an economy dominated by services rather than smokestacks, we no longer need to choose between economic growth and quality of life. They actually reinforce each other. We start at the north of the city with a proposal to build a new Arts Ribbon train platform at Dawes Point, similar to the one at Milsons Point. From a practical point of view, this takes pressure off Wynyard, which is actually becoming acute already and will be even more so once Barangaroo is up and running. But it can also make a statement about the Arts Ribbon precinct itself that stretches from Barangaroo around Walsh Bay and the Rocks to Circular Quay and the Art Gallery. We should unleash the creativity of our artistic community on the design of the station, and it can be a hub for visitors to get same-day tickets to artistic events throughout the precinct. Other sites shown on this slide include mixed-use redevelopments of the rundown Wynyard and Town Hall stations and the square across from the current Town Hall, including a tall, thin residential tower, green space and a bus interchange to keep the buses out of the city. There are heritage quality arts lands and lands title buildings in the city centre, actually just across from where we are now, which are currently used to house state bureaucrats and lands files. We know that there are top Asian hotel chains like the Mandarin Oriental and Raffles and the Peninsula that are considering putting hotels into Sydney, but have been put off, among other things, because they can't find the right sort of iconic sites. Our existing five-star hotels are at full occupancy. Why don't we invite one of these top chains that can put Sydney on the global map for the tourist market in place of land titles files? And why not have an Asia-Pacific campus of something like the Harvard Kennedy School of Government in the education building and relocate some of the public service jobs to other parts of the city or to Parramatta? Lower Oxford Street is a good place to try a more business and resident-driven approach to flexible zoning and council regulations, which are currently very rigid. It made sense to separate chemical factories and people's houses, but the world has changed, and you'll only support a retail sector in Sydney if you actually have residents, offices, coffee shops and retail in the same sorts of buildings and localities. The next challenge is the fish markets, still attracting visitors even in its current shambolic state. A few million dollars separates the bid and ask to resolve the current standstill with the lessees, and if we get this right, this could become one of the most popular tourist attractions and most of the exciting areas that Sydney has to offer our largest tourist markets. At Central Station, there should be iconic residential towers and green space. Sydney actually has one of the lowest residential densities of any major city, a counterintuitive result for a CBD that's constrained on three sides by water. Although Sydney's centre is not Manhattan, it does have some similar topography, but a quarter as many people living in each square kilometre. So perhaps it's no wonder that the theatre, retail and art scenes are livelier in New York on weekends than they can be for those of us who spend time in the middle of Sydney on weekends. There's also scope for further residential accommodation at other council-owned property, places like Goulburn Street and Lower Oxford Street. The Green Square development is an excellent one, but it's taken almost 20 years to come to the point of starting to build. We shouldn't have to wait another 20 years to have this completed. Of course, the how is just as important as the what when it comes to issues of planning, especially given the chequered history in New South Wales. Our proposal is to empower an existing entity, the Central Sydney Planning Committee, which is currently a reactive body dealing with developments worth more than $50 million. The CSPC can take a proactive role as a one-stop shop for Council and New South Wales Government in engaging the private sector. Within 1 year of council election, they could call for private sector proposals for these 10 strategic sites and would have a timetable to break dirt by the end of the four-year term. It's also worth considering the use of citizen juries to support the aesthetic judgment around design for these key strategic sites. Importantly, these sorts of decisions have greater public legitimacy and can justify a more expedited approval process. Government departments and authorities like transport, roads, planning, environment and the like would be able to register their views with the CSPC, but the CSPC would be empowered to make final decisions. The final section of our five-year strategy is about ways to promote clustering of businesses and cultural groupings within the city, based on sectors that offer the best potential for meaningful and interesting jobs in the 21st century. These centres of excellence will be hubs for arts and creative industries, finance and professional services, education and health, hospitality and entertainment, design and new media, Asian food and culture, retail and environmental and other technologies. There's a city election, council election on the 8th of September. Our report is a non-partisan plan and we're not recommending any specific candidates. But we do see this report as a blueprint which we hope will be adopted by some or all of the contenders to lead our city, as well as by the state government whose cooperation is important. As our region gets richer, there are more and more people prepared to pay a premium for shopping, services and entertainment, for the novel, high-end creative experiences that can only be found in the world's great cities. We know that other cities in our region are acting on this right now. The opportunity is there for Sydney to not only match but to exceed them. But it does require firm and clear action that connects clear and specific initiatives and mobilises the stakeholders. If we can shake off our complacency and make these investments, there's no reason why the next decade shouldn't establish Sydney's reputation as a truly vibrant, competitive and great global city. Thank you.
I don't need this.
No. Can we turn that off? Can you turn that off, Anthony? Can we turn this off?
Don't worry, I'll, just as long as I don't press any buttons, that's all.
Here we go. Just hang on, folks.
Demanding.
Okay, so Jacqueline Wilcox is going to start.
Trying not to muck this up.
They need to talk into the microphone.
Okay. Look, I think it's quite brave, really, of me to be here because I hail from that planned of Planned Cities Adelaide. And the fact that I'm here to talk to you about Sydney, which I think is a city metamorphosed by non-conformists whose convict chains are still being heard over the latte cups. And it's probably because I spent my teen years and my early adult years in ordered Anglican Adelaide that I'm reminded of the words of British architect Stephen Gardner, who said that what people want, above all, is order. Now, born and bred Sydneysiders might prefer their American cousin, Dwight Eisenhower, who boasted that he always found plans to be useless, but planning, he said, was indispensable. Now, as someone who advises business in a planned way, I think I can say without offending the business chamber and other groups that admirably represent business in the city, that I think, from my point of view, business welcomes certainty. So clear thinking, less zeitgeist-chasing projects, safe and attractive streets, functioning traffic without the need for a bike helmet, support for purchasing freely in whichever month we choose, and some decent rubbish collection would be a start. And then I'd like to add some signposting too, which would be most welcome. So let's get a few basics right, and then we can move on to these very lofty recommendations that Andrew's extremely thorough report digs into and discusses. So Andrew's going to blush, and he'll deny it, but it seems people have taken notice. He mentioned in his report citizens' juries as part of the planning process, and I noticed that recently Planning Minister Brad Hazzard will introduce committees or local committees into the process. So, you know, they are listening, Andrew, and some of them are even on the same page. But when I moved to Sydney, I was actually perversely impressed with all the traffic congestion here. Back then, congestion meant to me big city success, and I was quite a small towner. So I sucked it up. But now, as a local, I can say that it really gets up my nose and also costs. I'm very aware that it costs the New South Wales economy dearly. The most recent estimate, I think, by Transport Minister Berejiklian is about $8 billion by 2020. And the price of all the traffic jams that we have in the city could end up to be almost $70 billion. So what does this mean for business? For those of us who are in the city, it means a fair amount of planning just to get about. The NRMA says that about 50% of businesses have changed their operations to cope with traffic congestion. And a lot of businesses now resort to rescheduling meetings or not scheduling meetings in the first part of the day, just because it's so difficult to get to them. So that usually wipes out about 2 hours of our working day. Staff, even the most junior, now have to have smartphones just to so they keep in contact with us and do business when they're stuck on the bus. But cynics would note that Sydney has this mountain of useless plans that Eisenhower talked about, but not much of the indispensable planning. And Andrew has called the current planning process in his report dysfunctional. His report takes the best bit from a mountain of planning, planning reports, and adds to it with his own valuable insights. And the telling part for me, that is somebody who has to always consider business imperatives, is his financial insights. Because I, being a Luddite, I actually don't care where the art and technology precincts are or how many festivals or displays we have or even how high the buildings climb. I just care that we have them. And for me, it's important that we have order, clever, unique designs and events that bring the city alive and that we can afford them, along with all the other necessities of a sophisticated, functioning city. But Andrew's report details the considerable reserves, as you've heard, that the council has accumulated. And he says, for example, that the council could pay for light rail and not notice a dent in the available funds. So, again, Andrew's going to blush, but his comments regarding council spending on urgently needed infrastructure have been noted. And last week, I think it was, that the media reported that they're going to make that the moves afoot to make sure councils actually spend that rate money they collect on valuable infrastructure projects, including, you know, repairing those footpaths and potholes that trip us up. Now, I recall that this pedestrian-like stuff was a bit of a gripe of ratepayers in the city about a decade ago. I was then an advisor to then-independent Lord Mayor Frank Sartor and his election running mates Lucy Turnbull and Dixie Colton. Now, these are big thinkers. They understood what it meant to take the city with them as they put their big ideas in place. And Frank will agree, and I think most of you here that will agree, that Lucy and Dixie were much more diplomatic than he. But he did get things done, and he didn't particularly care how. But at that time, for me, it seemed to work. He was on building sites after hours and also on weekends, and sometimes he would drag me around with him while he badgered builders and demanded action. So door-knocking residents and businesses then revealed that they even had high on their list of concerns safety and accessibility. These were closely followed by spending on roads, footpaths, lighting, traffic, so not much really changes. Interestingly, what was of interest to me at that time as somebody who is interested in strategy was that Frank chose to continue that very intrusive paving program across all the footpaths of the CBD during the election campaign. I thought that was madness, but he continued. And whilst a number of businesses were pretty cross about the intrusion, the blocking of the access to their premises, the noise and the dust, they were a bit realistic about what paving the streets meant. And it was a plan, it seemed to me at the time, that they were stoically bearing as if they were all in it together. I suspect, though, that it helped that Frank lived in the city and walk to work each day. He would drop in on all these coffee shops and places and listen to the owners as they berated him, really, for what he was doing, what his paving program was doing for his business and how much it was costing their business, sorry, and how much it was costing them. You see, I'm not a town planner and I'm not even a town planning watcher, but I do have a working association with brands and brand protection, and I actually care about the city of Sydney and the image of Sydney. I care very much that it remains one of the world's great cities. But as Andrew's report highlights and what he's told you tonight, is that this can't be assured without some action. We've been hearing very loud this mock outrage that Brisbane, of all cities, beat Sydney to the G20. And Minister Brad Hazzard thundered that Sydney is Australia's only global city and it should have got the G20 on that merit alone. So Sydney is, as Andrew points out in his report, the gateway to Australia, and he said, as he did tonight, that complacency is a risk. You might recall that former Prime Minister Paul Keating once famously drew on the words of a New York mayor when he said that if you're not in Sydney, you're camping out. And it's that sort of endearing brashness that helps make Sydneysiders who we are, but it also leads to the type of smugness that Andrew warns us against. So as we hold mirrors up to our harbour, Brisbaneites, Melburnians, and even my Methodist Adelaide aunts would claim that Sydney relies on its looks. Their cities, they'd chorus, have much more interesting personalities, or at least they've got functioning traffic, airports, and my beloved signposts. A few years ago, I was advising an American defence company, and I had to spend a lot of time with defence administration in Canberra. Now, you might not be surprised to learn that they were telling me then that Sydney was up itself, and they meant it in a kind way. But they consequently said that we were being overtaken by more interesting upstart, albeit dowdy, cities without a harbour like Adelaide in attracting business, particularly defence business. Adelaide had at that time stunned the bureaucrats when it approached the department to host the annual Defence and Industry Conference. Now, this event attracts global defence companies, journalists, defence departments, and other assorted gunrunners like me. Canberra had hosted the conference since its inception, but its convention centre was being renovated, so it wouldn't be available. So Adelaide seized the moment. And the fair-minded Defence Department decided that they couldn't just hand this great business opportunity to the Adelaideans. So they, in true Canberra style, they called for a competition. Now, Adelaide's representative, I'm told, arrived personally with a mile-high submission. Melbourne faxed theirs. And Sydney, well, after the department called them, wondering where our application was, I'm told that one of our bureaucrats answered, "If you want to run a conference in Sydney, just go to our website." Now, Adelaide has been hosting that conference ever since. It has also stolen some defence company operations. It competes effectively for large defence contracts, and it even organised some of its tertiary education sector around the industry. Now, Sydney has only just woken up to that missed opportunity, and I'm assured it's developing strategies to fix it. So Andrew has actually similar stories of this sort of relying on our good looks complacency. But I have to say it's not all dire. Recently, Barry Humphreys, a man with a certain design pedigree, said that some of the horrors that have beset Sydney that don't leave him cold. He said it's still a pretty nice place to live. And I think we'll all agree. I mean, I still don't live in Adelaide anymore, but I think if we ask ourselves the question, is it a nice place to work or run a business? And for bus commuters stuck on the bridge each morning in what is a ridiculous queue, jostling for room along the city's arterial streets, the answer is not so equivocal. Regardless of those cute, underused bike lanes, those bus queues are not getting any shorter and the streets are not less congested. And at the end of the business day, footpaths are often impassable with lengthy, sometimes double-breasted lanes of people waiting for their crowded bus to take them home. Now, I noticed that recently one bus commuter wrote to the paper to say that it had taken her an hour to move from Central to Wynyard. So congestion might be the price of success, but we do know of other cities that have many more people than we do and move people around a lot better than we do. So it was a relief for me to learn that the head of Sydney's Traffic and Transport Committee has had to veto some recent ideas. It had to veto some ideas and had to bring what they called some sort of sensible planning to the city. Now, personally, I thought that was a tautology. I thought sensible planning would have been tautologist. And those closer to these things tell me that that's actually quite an ambitious thought. But we need only to point to this gobsmackingly silly idea of the councils to spend thousands of dollars on a campaign encouraging shoppers not to purchase anything new for a whole month. It's more than silly. It's actually insulting to retailers and service industries that bring life to this city. They struggle to pay wages, council rates, rents, just to operate in this precinct. And what do they get in return? They get their council that's actually flush with funds, supporting a campaign that will stall their cash flow. So, as Andrew suggests, those funds would actually allow them to invest in no end of projects that would make the city even more attractive to big spenders and people who would like something new. But what would be new would be if business could get some sort of freeze on rates during this this indulgent time when the council sort of spends on another wacky elitist social experiment. I mean, we have to ask ourselves what's next, a ban on purchasing Darrell Lee chocolates or full-fat milk, or the mind boggles. But this sort of assault on trading has resonated with the public. It may well be a defining moment, actually, as far as perception of the council goes. And I say this because my team, some of whom are here from Weber Shandwick, tested the council online talk in early July, and the Buy Nothing New month created the most discussion. What is surprising is that at that time, and this is the 30 days prior to July 10, there were only two pieces of mainstream media related to that the council's campaign. However, a significant amount of Twitter conversation was devoted to it, and it was predominantly negative conversation that noted the already difficult retail climate. So this was before the Darrell Lee fiasco. So Andrew has noted that our region is you know, awash with cashed-up middle classes and wealthy people who are all prepared to pay for quality services and shopping and entertainment, all the things that we expect to have in a global city. He points out that our competitor cities in the region have been preparing for this for some time, and that that Sydney must grab the opportunity to beat them or at least compete effectively. So as Andrew says, it requires action that connects specific and considered initiatives and mobilises all the stakeholders. And I would add that it doesn't require pandering to ideologues with sort of naive initiatives that are the antithesis of a functioning, solvent, vibrant, global trading city.
Thank you. Right, so we come to questions and discussion. If I could just ask everyone to speak into the microphone, and you might help me just reset this. It's a bit. Before we come to questions and discussion, thanks to Cause James Westgarth for the use of this fine facility this evening, and we'll just get our microphone. Andrew, if you just come up here, if you stand on this side, Jacqueline, you stand on this side, I'll disappear over there. See if we can talk into the microphone, talk down the back of the room. Maybe I'll start coming off the back of what Jacqueline said to Andrew. As I understand it, local government has no position in the constitution. So in a sense, local government is controlled by state government. In this state, the state of New South Wales. So what can the state government do, the new coalition government in Macquarie Street, in relation to the problems that have come about by an unwillingness of the city council to invest, or the other various problems that occur with bikeways and cycle paths and whatever? I mean, let's start with Andrew, then we go to Jacqueline, then we go to the rest of the room. Andrew. Okay. Speak in the mic.
Yeah, look, I think it is an issue that, as Jacqueline has said, the new state government is focused on, and based on conversations that I've had and things that we've seen, I think these issues of planning, infrastructure and so on are obviously things that they are very focused on. I guess the issue the state government has is that they do have a whole bunch of issues in Western Sydney and in rural New South Wales which demand attention as well, and a relatively limited budget. And I guess what's what stands out when you look at the numbers is that there's a lot of money in the local government, and there's the need is for some cooperation that allows those funds to be used to satisfy some of the issues in the core of the city, and free up money for dealing with some of the other issues in the west. I don't know if you'd agree with that.
No, I don't think that. I mean, yeah. Andrew's got the in-depth knowledge on this.
Speaking of that,
Andrew obviously has the in-depth knowledge on this. I have had those sort of chats too, and I do think they're trying their best, but there are those constraints that Andrew said.
But can't a state government force a council to do something if it wants to?
We need our lawyers here, I think.
Can the state government force a council? No one knows.
Yes, of course.
Well, they can. David Bennett says the state government can
force a council to act.
Yes, to amend the Local Government Act to say what they want.
So David Bennett saying just you amend the Local Government Act to say what the state government wants. Now, right, so who's question here and then here? Yep, right. Yep, you're right.
Looking for a microphone?
No, we don't have one, so just speak up. Speak
okay. Thanks for a very interesting sort of duality of views. It sounds like there's no lack of good ideas, but what there's a lack of is perhaps an ability to act in a concerted way to move there. That's sort of what I'm drawing a little bit. And we've seen it perhaps in some other areas such as medical research. The difference between Sydney's personality and other cities such as, say, Melbourne, where Melbourne got major cancer funding from the federal government, whereas Sydney actually does more cancer research than Melbourne does, but the difference is that they got their act together and made a joint, coordinated presentation and approach to the whole issue, whereas in Sydney there's a great fragmentation and an inability somehow to pull ourselves together. So if we agree that that's the case, and it would be great to have other examples that aren't, I'm thinking back to something like the Olympics, which take us back to the pre-2000 years, where that was a great event. It worked for Sydney. What are some lessons that we can learn about how that was structured, and as Jared pointed forward, maybe different levels of government? Where can we look for some solutions there?
Yeah, look, I think I think you're absolutely right. I mean, as you say, there's, you know, certainly when I mean, I spent 3 or 4 months working, putting this report together, and as Jacqueline said, there's no shortage of good ideas in Sydney. There's no shortage of reports. There's dozens of reports on different things. What we haven't been so good at is the governance. And that gets to how local and state government work together to actually get results, and I think actually getting all the stakeholders and places like Melbourne and Singapore tend to be a bit better at doing that. So I think one of the reasons that we did focus in this report on what are the practical ways that you can change the governance arrangement. So we sort of focused on that Central Sydney Planning Committee as one way of doing that. I think, as David said, the state government does have the ability to override local government in everything. I think the view that they've taken to date has been to try to do it consultatively and cooperatively, and I guess we just need to sort of see where that gets to.
Jacqueline, do you want to add to that?
No.
David, do you want to just speak right into the microphone?
I was interested in the remark about the light rail. Was any consideration given to monorail instead of light rail, which is silent, future-looking instead of retro-looking, much less labour-intensive, doesn't interfere with traffic, and can deliver people to first-floor retail outlets? It just seems to me so obvious that what we need to put in all the main streets of the city is lots of monorails rather than big clunky light rail in the middle of the road blocking traffic.
That's
do you want to take
yours.
That one? Yeah, look, I think the rightly or wrongly, there has been a lot of discussion of different options, and the view does seem to be that that aesthetically in terms of the number of people that you can actually transport, that light rail is sort of a tram type of system is the best balance between the aesthetics and actually practically being able to take those 400 buses an hour out of the city. If anyone wants to comment on that, no?
Well, we'll go up the front and then we'll go to John. So, yes, speak at the microphone.
Jacqueline, I don't suppose you'll give us any names about who to vote for, but what sort of questions should we ask candidates in the coming election to get an idea of what would get a sensible person winning the election rather than someone silly?
Now, Hilary, I've sat next to you at far too many Sydney Institute speeches, and I don't think you need my advice on who to ask and what questions to ask. You've asked some pretty good questions.
It's a cop out. There you go. John, speak in the microphone. Right?
The first of my family came to Sydney in 1853 to build Fort Denison as a foreman stonemason, therefore I'm a very committed Sydney-sider. To my great horror, in the last 48 hours, I've heard Jerry Brownlee, the Minister for Construction in New Zealand, the Minister in charge responsible for rebuilding Christchurch after the devastation, and Bernard Salt this morning, demographer, explaining that Melbourne is going to become our biggest city in Australia within a few years. And in the case of the New Zealanders, they're looking to Melbourne as their model for rebuilding Christchurch because of its transport, its accessibility to really good precincts for arts and culture, sport, all of that sort of stuff, and just a sheer capacity to make people feel much better. In neither case was Sydney mentioned favourably. What's happened to our mojo?
Question about Sydney's
merger. Well, I mean, I think that it goes back to what I was saying when I was working with my defence client, and the Defence Department were telling me that, you know, what's wrong with Sydney? This is a few years ago. What's wrong with Sydney? We've got this great opportunity, and they weren't even interested. And I spoke to some people in the government at the time, and they thought that I was a bit crazy and that I was making a mountain out of a molehill. That I think, you know, I mean, it does sound very simple, but I think Andrew's right. We are very, very complacent. We do think we're pretty hot. And meanwhile, you get boring cities like, you know, dare I say it, Adelaide, and as you've pointed out, Melbourne, who just seize the moment because they don't have our natural beauty and try and make what they can with what they've got.
You want to add to that?
Yeah, no, look, I think that's right, and I think we, you know, that's anecdotally what we hear from people, but I think it's also what, when you actually analyse the benchmarking studies and some of the numbers, it is that. But I think the good news from that is because we've got all the natural attributes to a much greater extent than many of those cities, if we can actually get even close in terms of the strategy and the getting the stakeholders together, then obviously we'll leave places like Melbourne for dust.
There's a question here.
Yeah. Oh, hi, Andrew. You've concentrated on the city of Sydney, but surely Sydney's not going to become a truly global city until it gets more than the city of Sydney behind it. I mean, we've been held back by a plethora of local councils. Surely all the plans in the world for the city of Sydney are not going to turn
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's always hard with these things to know how big to make it, and so the decision was to particularly focus on that area because it is where most of the visitors are, the cultural institutions are, the educational institutions are, and actually 25% of the New South Wales GDP is just in that council area, about 10% of Australia's total GDP. So, yeah, I guess Greater Sydney can't succeed without inner city succeeding, but you are right, and I guess getting to that point of state government responsibilities, there clearly are a bunch of issues related to road. I think one of the ones that that I think is very consistent with what we're saying in Sydney is getting a higher speed rail connection to Parramatta. Because you only need to get that route down to about 15 minutes, which is relatively easy to do with the current... I shouldn't say relatively easy, but it can be done with the existing corridor. And it actually makes it much more practical for a lot of support services to be based out there. So you can have both Sydney going up and services going out and clear congestion both those ways.
Stephen.
Yes, thanks. I can't remember which one of the speakers was. It could have been Andrew, but I think you made the comment about the importance of connection between people living in city residences and business. It seemed to my untutored eye that a lot of discussion about Sydney is always the next big thing. Can we get a convention centre? And all those things I understand are important. And about business, you've got to get traffic through, you've got to be able to get parking, you've got to be able to trucks deliver services. It's all about business. We don't in Sydney seem to focus too much on human beings living in the city. So you walk around the city on the weekend, there's just tumbleweeds everywhere. Whereas cities, that's what it seems to me why cities, a lot more tourists want to go to cities like Siena rather than Seoul in the world, which seem to be quite good about doing business. How important is it, do you think, to actually have the city as a place where people do want to live and spend time on the weekends as opposed to just a good place to extract money?
I think it's critically important. And as I said, it was interesting when you look at the relative density in terms of, you know, the number of people living per square kilometre, that Sydney is, you know, a quarter of Manhattan. It's you know, a third of London, and in a number of other cities, including Melbourne's and so on. And it's important in a couple of different ways. It's important because it allows retailers and artistic cultural venues to have more natural traffic because people are walking around. We also have this issue in Sydney where 70% of the jobs are to the east of Parramatta, but 50% of the people are to the west of Parramatta. So again, rather than building further and further out with all the infrastructure and things that you need there, where there are opportunities, and central stations an obvious example, where you can do more density, it's not Potts Point or Glebe or areas where there's heritage concerns and issues on the same scale. It makes houses more affordable. It's better environmentally. It saves on infrastructure, and it also introduces that vibrancy.
There's a question here. Yes, just stand up. Speak in the microphone.
Up until the last year or so, retail has brought a lot of people into the city.
Yeah.
With the huge growth in online shopping, where do you see the future of the department stores and the big retail centres? Is that going to change plans, do you think, in the foreseeable future?
Yeah. Do you want to comment? Or
no.
I think there is, and you're seeing this in other parts of the world as well, and it's one of the things that the mayors in places like New York and London are grappling with as well, that there has been a big shift in the way people shop, and what that means is that the kind of shopping that is going to be successful is where there's actually an experience, there's surrounding entertainment and those sorts of things. So again, it gets to this issue that you can't just have a shop sitting there and expect that people are going to come from 20 kilometres away. You actually need to have much more mixed zoning that allows retail to coexist with residents and with entertainment and the coffee shops and all those sorts of things.
There's a question down the back. Speak in the microphone.
I don't know if this has been covered already. I don't know, the acoustics is pretty bad over here. As far as forward planning is concerned, isn't the first basis for any major city to have forward planning? And before you can do anything, you've got to have formal planning. Now, I find in Sydney that it's most unusual that you've got so many municipalities which are moving in different directions. And not only that, but what they're doing is they're making decisions for their area, and what's happening is that there is no coordination. Is it not your view that there should be one municipality to cover Sydney so that there can be a proper forward planning and a proper building of a city?
Okay. One big Sydney, one greater Sydney is the suggestion.
No, Brisbane.
Yeah, and Brisbane does have that. Melbourne's got a halfway house where there's not the 30 councils that you have within the Greater Sydney area, but they're not. It's not all one the way it is in Brisbane. Yeah, the state government is thinking about this. I think, and there is a review of local government that the ministers commissioned to look at these issues of governance. And I guess we'll sort of see where that comes out.
Jacqueline, are you a big Sydney person?
Definitely, yes, I'm a big Sydney person.
Well, tell us about it. Why are you a big Sydney person?
Oh, goodness me. I actually lived in Melbourne as well, and I found Melbourne to be just a big Adelaide. It is actually a big Adelaide with nicer shopping. But to your point earlier, actually, about the retail experience, what I find really interesting is, yes, you say about the rise in online shopping and people wanting to have this shopping experience. But I'm a bit of a market Nazi. I tend to go around and look at them and watch people and see what's going on. And it's really surprised me about the growth of markets. So whilst people are not coming into the city to shop, they're actually trekking around to all the different suburban markets and really crowding them out. A lot of markets are saying they're having a great deal of difficulty coping with the numbers of people and the pressures that puts on those market sites. So it's telling me then that I think what people want from shopping is changing. And to your point, Andrew, we've actually got one of our staffers is heading off on a holiday. Now, this woman is taught me how to online shop, and she's actually going to New York. Why? For shopping. So that's what she plans to do for the whole week, bless her. We've all put in our orders, but she could probably get a lot of what she's going to purchase there online. But she's going there for that New York shopping experience.
Question here.
Yes. It seems to me that Sydney's still divided into tribes. The best example I can give is the number of years it took to get one ETAG to get around the place. So, and people still say to me, I'm a manly boy, or I've been in Bondi all my life. So where do we go from here? How can we develop a common pride in all of Sydney rather than being a manly boy or a Bondi girl?
I actually think that's relevant for all cities. People claim to be from Melbourne or Adelaide or Sydney, but then will say, but I'm more than that, I'm a manly person or a North Sydney girl or whatever. I don't actually find anything wrong with that, except for the ETAG thing that drives me nuts. I'll tell you another thing that drives me nuts is when I have clients or guests, particularly guests from Europe, will come and they cannot work out what is the advantage of buying a return ticket, because it's just the price of two singles and things like that we haven't really sort of thought out. That those sorts of things, to your point, bother me more, that we haven't really got this whole thing of how do we get around our entire city. That bothers me more than whether people think that they're a manly person or a Fuji person. I think that's quite sweet, actually.
Yeah, I think you can have both, and you don't need to choose between having different identities and precincts and neighbourhoods, villages. But at the same time, it is important to have that framework that allows you to project yourself as a global city against others. I'd just make a point on the transport thing. One of the more controversial recommendations in our report was making the light rail down George Street free, which is not something that's... But, you know, as we looked at it, for the actual running costs, which are around about $10 million a year, when you've got $560 million a year coming in revenue, it seemed to us that if you make it free, you just cut down on a lot of that aggravation that people don't like having to change transport and get another ticket. And even if you introduce uniform ticketing, which the New South Wales State Government is working on, things are changing very rapidly. So it may well be not too long a time you'll actually work out where you're going on your phone and just walk through and swipe that. So there is a danger that you end up with a technology that costs $5 or $6 million a year to maintain and to police and becomes obsolete very quickly.
And in your proposal, what would be the loss to revenue if a light rail down George Street were free? I mean, in other words, how much money would you collect if it wasn't free?
I think the way we thought about it is what does it cost you to operate? Yeah, which is probably around about $10 million, based on some benchmarks. Now, in a way, how much revenue would you collect? I suppose it's a bit of a function of the pricing, because if you have it free, you're going to have it used a lot more. If you push the price up, you're going to have less people using it. So there is some revenue foregone, but on balance, it seemed to us it was still something that should be considered.
Recent events in King's Cross and also out west with guns suggest that public safety is an issue. How are you factoring that into your planning?
Clearly that's a key issue, and I think again one of the things that you see in the big cities is that they do spend a lot of time thinking about policing. Cameras, transport. I mean, if you take King's Cross as a particular example, you know, there clearly are entertainment precincts in different parts of the world that go all night and that don't have some of those issues. There's got to be a focus on transport. There's got to be a focus on CCTV cameras in the right places, and that's something that London in particular uses quite a lot, and focus on the right enforcement of liquor laws as well.
I've got a view on that.
Yeah.
I think this is because of my Adelaide birthplace, but I actually think that Sydney's got this real schizophrenic view of violence and crime. On one hand, when terrible tragedies like the incident you referred to occur, we all hang our heads in despair and shake our heads wondering what to do about it. And the next time, we actually celebrate the fact that we're quite dangerous and we're on the cutting edge. And we have, we actually have in a lot of our newspapers, in the society pages, there'll be references to King's Cross identities being seen having lunch somewhere. So on one hand, we sort of demonise it all, but on the other hand, we celebrate it. So I think it's a little bit more than just having safe precincts. It's about our attitude to violence and to crime. Melbourne is a bit similar too, but I must say, coming from Law and Order Adelaide, I was quite surprised that people like that sort of edginess, and it has these consequences.
There's a question here. We're nearly finished. Yes, got to be quick.
I've recently, in the last 3 or 4 years, been to Asia, America, Europe,
okay,
as a tourist, and I think one of the things that we suffer for when I come in here and talk to people who have been here is the whole concept of providing service. And I think it goes right back to our original origins, particularly in New South Wales. If you accept the idea that giving service is a really good thing, then the administrators will be looking at what they should do to give service to the people. And our business operators should be doing the same thing, giving service. And I think you'd find, like in New York, you get your shopping, right?
Okay.
I think you'd find that concept would actually resonate throughout the community.
We got it. You need better service. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of this is also moving from an economy which is about mining and manufacturing and things like that to services and particularly our exports, which is where it becomes particularly relevant, where people maybe have got used to different levels of service. I mean, I think Australia has its own character, and I think tourists actually welcome that. I think the way that service is delivered in some other countries, may not always be to our taste as well. But I think a lot of it comes to recognising the change in the economy and where the earnings are coming from, and actually say whether it's through training or hiring policies or whatever, making sure that's recognised. Mm. I don't know if you have a different
view. Final quick question: I know you're not running for mayor, but if you did become mayor in October or November, or what would be the first priority or the first couple of priorities you would do? Just quick responses to yourself. Andrew, what would you do first?
I think the first priority would be to really set out to look at those strategic sites. So it's the 10 kind of key areas where you can get a real bang for buck by just in investing a small amount of money to actually really transform the experience. And I think that gets to, it's really transport and infrastructure. I mean, I think as all that data suggests, the we do fine on a lot of areas, but if we can get that that infrastructure and some of those key sites right, then everything flows much more quickly.
Well, I think I'd implement Andrew's report.
Well, there are a lot of people here. I know there are more questions, but we're right on 7 o'clock, so I thought it's a good time to finish. Look, it's been a fascinating discussion tonight. I've learned some stuff about Sydney local government I didn't know. I'm sure we all have. And obviously, as some of the questioners made clear and the speakers made clear as well, there is a real problem in Sydney, contemporary Sydney. So, and it was also great to have comparisons with international cities and other cities within Australia on top of that, because we do compete in Sydney with other cities internationally and locally. So many thanks to Andrew Lowe, and in particular for his report, Global Sydney. And to Jacqueline Wilcox for her fine commentary. It's great to have an Adelaide Sheila along and giving us a bit of class is just what we needed. Not that Andrew didn't have class, but it always helps to bring a bit along. So many thanks to both of you. And the talks will be on the podcast tomorrow. The papers will be published in the Sydney papers online shortly. Thanks for coming.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.